Hey everybody, Marcus here. The sentiment of looking for your other half and the notion of platonic love are two concepts within Western culture that I suspect most people do not understand the origins of. The sentiment of looking for your other half is freely expressed in common discourse as a sentiment in finding, a relationship partner. The notion of platonic love, on the other hand, is a sentiment expressing a form of love for someone but absent the sexual component. These, however, are mere half-truths. And in the case of the latter, the case of platonic love, a vulgar and base understanding that would be funny if it was not so depressingly obvious that even though this term is so common, people have no idea how important platonic love is to understanding what love is, meaning the form of love, what the essence of love is. The origin of both of these concepts, searching for your other half and platonic love, are found in Plato's dialogue entitled Symposium. Now, a symposium, as it was referred to in the times of Socrates, meaning around 450 BC, was a drinking party. A drinking party where you were obligated to drink copious amounts of wine. However, it was not some, Greek orgy as one would imagine. Well, at least not usually. Often, a symposium was an event where distinguished people would sit around discussing topics of importance while getting completely smashed. However, the wine used at a symposium was traditionally watered down, so one part wine to three parts water. Well, at least these are the ratios they would start with. Now, Plato's dialogue Symposium, as you would guess, is the retelling of such a drinking party. After the dialogue Republic, the Symposium is considered the greatest works of Plato. The Symposium takes place at the house of Agathon. Now, Agathon is a young, attractive poet who just won the annual religious festival's competition for Greek tragedies. Now, Agathon is also a student of Gorgias. Gorgias is a well-known sophist, so whenever you get a character who is taught by Gorgias, you know that there will be corruption within the soul of the student. Now, on the way to the house of Agathon, Socrates stops mid-track and, sort of spaces out in thought. This is one of those quirks about Socrates. He'll just go into this trance for an undetermined amount of time, thinking about important things, one would assume. So, the party begins without Socrates, and the other guests talk about the seating arrangements and where everyone will be positioned during the event. What is important about the seating arrangements is the proximities of bodies. You see, the Socratic idea of love has nothing to do with the proximity of bodies as much as it has to do with the proximity of souls, whereas these other guests have not reached that level of understanding of Eros, and their conception of Eros is largely consisting in physical reality. So, the connection of bodies, the touching of bodies, has a large homosexual component to it. Most of the men invited to the party have some sort of sexual relationship with one another, with the exclusion of Socrates and Aristophanes, who have no homosexual connection to each other or any of the other guests. Another connection between the guests is that they are either poets of some kind or another and educated by sophists. So, all in all, the attendants are all corrupt souls, except Socrates. And this corruption of the soul comes out in their conception of love. Let's imagine that Eros is a sort of marrow of the soul. The way the center of a bone has a marrow. When these guests make their speeches on the conception of love, what they will be unintentionally but clearly doing is reflecting the internal organization of their souls. The thing we love is a reflection of us. And when we make a speech in praise of our conception of love, and what love is, and what is worth loving, and what is truly lovable, what we are really doing is making a statement of what the center of our soul really looks like. Now, what had been agreed by the guests of this symposium is that each guest would make a speech in praise of the God of love. On the surface, each speech will be exactly that, a praise of love. But below the surface, what each man is really doing is putting his hand on the table and proclaiming, "This is what I am." Because like we said, you are what you love. Now, when Socrates finally makes his way into the house, he takes a seat next to Agathon. In Greek, the word agathon means the good. And you can clearly see the symbolism of Socrates taking his place closest to the good. Let's remember from my first video on philosophical method where I explained Plato's allegory of the divided line and the allegory of the sun. The good in Platonic metaphysics is reality itself. The good is that at which everything aims at. And to possess knowledge of the good is to possess knowledge of all of reality, the meaning of existence, and so forth. Now, before the speeches begin, these men state that they don't want this to be a drunken mess because, well, most of them are still hungover from the night before. Now, this is already an indication of their immoderation, which, as we know from Aristotle, is an excess, therefore a vice. So all these men are riddled with vice. They are driven by their passions, and you can already infer that their speeches about love will come from this sort of vice-ridden soul. So each of the guests have a soul sickness of sorts, each of them sick in their own way. Of course, there is a plurality of sicknesses, but only a single form of health. Socrates, just a note, is the only one not hungover. Well, surprise, surprise. Now, what I have described so far is the setup for the dialogue. For our purposes, we are only concerned with the speeches made by Aristophanes and Socrates. Of the two, Aristophanes speaks first. Now, Aristophanes is one of the great comic poets in Athens. You can still purchase his surviving works at pretty much any bookstore these days. One thing to note about Aristophanes is that he did not hold Socrates in high regard. He authored a play called The Clouds, and in it he parodies Socrates. He makes Socrates look foolish, makes Socrates look impious, a corrupter of youths, an evil man who does bad things to his students. This play by Aristophanes gave currency to the idea in Athens that Socrates is a sophist. In one example from The Clouds, you see a man who has captured a flea and ties a leash to this flea's neck. This man then proceeds to stamp the flea's foot into wax in order to be able to measure the distance a flea can leap in flea feet. In Plato's dialogue entitled The Apology, Socrates stands trial under the accusation of corrupting the youth of Athens. In the speech that Socrates gives in his defense, Socrates says that the real accusers are not the three men who have brought Socrates to trial. No, the real accusers are those poets that have made everyone think that Socrates is a sophist, that Aristophanes, who has popularized slander about Socrates through his plays, is Socrates' real accuser. Okay. Let me read to you, in its entirety, the speech that Aristophanes gives about love. Now, Plato mimics the style of Aristophanes so accurately in this speech that scholars would accept it as an original if it was not part of Plato's dialogue. First, you must learn what human nature was in the beginning and what has happened to it since. Because long ago, our nature was not what it is now, but very different. There were three kinds of human beings. That's my first point. Not two, as there are now, male and female. In addition to these, there was a third, a combination of those two. Its name survives, though the kind itself has vanished. At that time, you see, the word androgynous really meant something, a form made up of male and female elements, though now there's nothing but the word, and that's used as an insult. My second point is that the shape of each human being was completely round. With back and sides in a circle, they had four hands each, as many legs as hands, and two faces, exactly alike, on a rounded neck. Between the two faces, which were on opposite sides, was one head with four ears. There were two sets of sexual organs, and everything else was the way you'd imagine it from what I've told you. They walked upright, as we do now, you know, whatever direction they wanted. And whenever they set out to run fast, they thrust out all their eight limbs, the ones they had then, and spun rapidly, the way gymnasts do cartwheels, by bringing their legs around straight. Now here's why there were three kinds, and why they were as I described them. The male kind was originally an offspring of the sun, and the female of the earth. And the one that combined both genders was an offspring of the moon, because the moon shares in both. They were spherical, and so was their motion, because they were like their parents in the sky. In strength and power, therefore, they were terrible. and they had great ambition. They made an attempt on the gods, and Hormuz's story about Ephialtes and Otus was originally about them. How they tried to make an ascent to heaven so as to attack the gods. Then Zeus and the other gods met in council to discuss what to do, and they were sore perplexed. They couldn't wipe out the human race with thunderbolts and kill them all off, as they had the giants, because that would wipe out the worship they received, along with the sacrifices we humans give them. On the other hand, they couldn't let them run riot. At last, after great effort, Zeus had an idea. "I think I have a plan," he said. "What would allow human beings to exist and stop their misbehaving? They will give us, they will give up being wicked when they lose their strength. So I shall now cut each of them in two. At one stroke, they will lose their strength and also become more profitable to us, owing to the increase in their number. They shall walk upright on two legs. But if I find they still run riot and they do not keep the peace," he said, "I will cut them in two again, and they'll have to make their way on one leg hopping." So saying, he cut those human beings in two, the way people cut sorb apples before they dry them, or the way they cut eggs with hairs. As he cut each one, he commanded Apollo to turn its face and half its neck towards the wound, so that each person would see that he'd been cut and keep better order. Then Zeus commanded Apollo to heal the rest of the wound. And Apollo did turn the face around, and he drew skin from all sides over what is now called the stomach. And there he made one mouth, and in a pouch with a drawstring, and fastened it at the center of the stomach. This is now called the navel. Then he smoothed out the other wrinkles, of which there were many, and he shaped the breasts using some such tool as a shoemaker had for smoothing wrinkles out of leather on the form. But he left a few wrinkles around the stomach and the navel to be a reminder of what happened long ago. Now, since their natural form had been cut in two, each one longed for its own other half, and so they would throw their arms about each other, weaving themselves together, wanting to grow together. In that condition, they would die from hunger and general idleness, because they would not do anything apart from each other. Whenever one of the halves died, and one was left, the one that was left still sought another and wove itself together with that. Sometimes the half he met came from a woman, as we'd call her now. Sometimes it came from a man. Either way, they kept on dying. Then, however, Zeus took pity on them and came up with another plan. He moved their genitals around to the front. Before then, you see, they used to have their genitals outside, like their faces. And they cast seed and made children, not in one another, but in the ground, like chickadees. So Zeus brought about this relocation of genitals, and in doing so, he invented interior reproduction, by the man in the woman. The purpose of this was so that when a man embraced a woman, he would cast his seed, and they would have children. But when male embraced male, they would at least have the satisfaction of intercourse, after which they could stop embracing, return to their jobs, and look after their own needs. This, then, is the source of our desire to love each other. Love is born into every human being. It calls back the halves of our original nature together. It tries to make one out of two and heal the wound of human nature. Each of us, then, is a matching half of a human whole, because each was sliced like a flatfish. Two out of one. And each of us is always seeking the half that matches him. That's why a man who is split from the double sword, which used to be called androgynous, runs after women. Many lecherous men have come from this class, and so do the lecherous women who run after men. Women who are split from a woman, however, pay no attention at all to men. They are oriented more towards women, and lesbians come from this class. People who are split from a male are male-oriented. While they are boys, because they are chips off the male block, they love men and enjoy lying with men and being embraced by men. Those are the best of boys and lads, because they are the most manly in their nature. Of course, some say such boys are shameless, but they're lying. It's not because they have no shame that such boys do this, you see, but because they are bold and brave and masculine, and they tend to cherish what is like themselves. Do you want me to prove it? Look, these are the only kind of boys who grew up to be real men in politics. When they've grown men, they are lovers of young men, and they naturally pay no attention to marriage or to making babies, except insofar as they are required by local custom. They, however, are quite satisfied to live their lives with one another unmarried. In every way, then, this sort of man grows up as a lover of young men and a lover of love, always rejoicing in his own kind. And so, when a person meets the half that is his very own, whatever his orientation, whether it's to young men or not, then something wonderful happens. The two are struck from their senses by love, by a sense of belonging to one another, and by desire, and they don't want to be separated from one another, not even for a moment. These are the people who finish out their lives together and still cannot say what it is they want from one another. No one would think it is intimacy of sex. That mere sex is the reason each lover takes so great and deep joy in being with the other. It's obvious that the soul of every lover longs for something else. His soul cannot say what it is, but like an oracle, it has a sense of what it wants. And like an oracle, it hides behind a riddle. Suppose two lovers are lying together, and Hephaestus stands over them with his mending tools, asking, "What is it you human beings really want from each other?" And suppose they're perplexed, and he asks them again, "Is this your heart's desire, then, for the two of you to become part of the same whole, as near as can be, and never to separate day or night? Because if that's your desire, I'd like to weld you together and join you into something that is naturally whole, so that the two of you are made into one. Then the two of you would share one life as long as you lived, because you would be one being. And by the same token, when you died, you would be one and not two in Hades, having died a single death. Look at your love and see if this is what you desire. Wouldn't this be all the good fortune you could want? Surely you can see that no one who received such an offering would turn it down. No one would find anything else while he wanted. Instead, everyone would think he'd found out at last what he had always wanted, to come together and melt together with the one he loved, so that one person emerged from two. Why should this be so? It's because, as I said, we used to be complete wholes in our original nature, and now love is the name of our pursuit of wholeness, for our desire to be complete. Long ago we were united, as I said, but now the god has divided us as punishment for the wrong we did him, just as the Spartans divided the Arcadians. So there's a danger that if we don't keep order before the gods, we'll be split in two again, and then we'll be walking around in the conditions of people carved on gravestones as bas relief, sawn apart between the nostrils like half dice. We should encourage all men, therefore, to treat the gods with all due reverence, so that we may escape this fate and find wholeness instead. And we will, if love is our guide and our commander. Let no one work against him. Whoever opposes love is hateful to the gods, but if we become friends of the gods and cease to quarrel with him, then we shall find the young men that are meant for us and win their love, as very few men do nowadays. Well, here we can clearly see where the origins of searching for your other half comes in. Aristophanes lays out that there used to be three sexes in the past, male, female, and androgynous. However, each of the beings represented by these sexes were composed of four arms and four legs, two heads, and so on. So when Zeus split these beings in half with his thunderbolt as a punishment for their hubris, we ended up with the sort of people we have now. Though Zeus could have killed these beings, he did not, because then there would be no one to make all those nice sacrifices, you know, rites and rituals for him. And that's how Zeus rolls. What is important to note is that when Zeus split the male sex, you ended up with two homosexual men. When he split the female sex, you ended up with two lesbians. And when he split the androgynous sex, you ended up with a straight man and a straight woman. So in this way, the homosexual man would look for another man as his other half, Same with the lesbian, and same with the straight man and woman. However, the other half was really the completion of the whole that originally existed, and this is the source of the yearning for that other half, the desire to merge back into a single being. And now, the only goal and desire in life for us is the desire to find our other half, regain our lost integrity in both senses, physically and spiritually, as without this other half, we are only partial people. Here is the really important part of the story, though. Remember when I said earlier that Eros is like the marrow of the soul, and how a man talks of love is their confession of the internal organization of their soul? Well, this story is an explanation of the internal organization of the soul of Aristophanes and everyone else in modern times who clings to this idea of finding their other half. See, Aristophanes is only half a man. He's not a whole integrated human being, and for that reason he projects his own desires, he projects his own conception of good, his conception of the healthy soul, onto his conception of love. In this myth, we originally started out as these chaotic monsters of impiety, and that's what Aristophanes is now. And also, today, human beings are not really any better. We're still chaotic monsters of impiety, but only split in two. And the best that we can possibly do is to have Zeus glue us back together one day, which is what will finally make us happy. Now, earlier in the dialogue, Socrates had said that Aristophanes is a fully pious man, a servant of Dionysus and Aphrodite. But what this really means is that Aristophanes is only in the service of sex and wine, as Aphrodite and Dionysus are the gods of these things, respectively. This is the most impious thing you can possibly devote yourself to. But Aristophanes sees himself as a conservative, pious man, which means that Aristophanes does not truly understand himself. Aristophanes is not only a great writer of comedy, his life is a great comedy. He's a clown that does not understand that he is constantly playing jokes on himself. As Aristophanes said, love is never to be withstood, and we must follow Eros wherever it goes, which basically translates to, Eros is what gives life meaning. Eros is what makes us happy, and the more we gratify our desires, the better off we shall be. It's a very unbalanced conception of self and of the good life. But this is exactly the comedy which plays itself out in the lives of those always in search of their other half. They have a corrupt soul, a soul still grounded in the pleasures of the flesh as their meaning to existence. Their fulfillment can only come by the presence of another, and as we all know, Eros is fleeting. So like a junkie, they will always be looking for that other half, never to find it, as their conception of the self is fundamentally wrong. Okay, now that we have identified the origin of this idea of finding your other half, we can move on. After the speech of Aristophanes, Agathon speaks next. Now, like I said earlier, Agathon was taught by the sophist Gorgias, so you know you will get a great speech, but a morally corrupt speech. As it turns out, Agathon is in love with himself. He loves himself in that most extreme form of narcissism. So Agathon's speech is really going to be about Agathon describing himself. You know, he is wearing a laurel wreath. He just had 30,000 people clapping for him over the days of the competition he won. This man is just swimming in self-love to the point that he describes himself as the new Homer, who will teach virtue to the people. He's embarked on a lifelong romance with himself. Finally, Socrates' turn to speak comes up. Socrates says that he has learned about love from a woman named Diotima. Now, Diotima in Greek means the honor of God, which is ironic as the nature of all the speeches was supposed to be to honor the god of love, Eros. Also, this is going to be the first speech of the night that has a heterosexual overtone to it. Socrates then moves on and says that he thinks that everyone has misunderstood the nature of love, that love is not a god, because the gods are perfect. They don't lack anything, nor do they need anything. But love lacks. Love, then, must be a daemon, a demigod, something between the earthly, the human, and the divine. Love is a longing for perfection. Love is a longing for truth. Love is a longing for wisdom and knowledge and beauty. And since it is a longing, it cannot be a god, as a god already possesses all these things and longs for nothing. Love is not a desire for bodies, but for the perfection of the soul. Next, Diotima walks Socrates up the ladder of beauty. Love is a longing for perfected beauty. And when we fall in love, we see the image of this perfected beauty in the person we have fallen in love with. Now, if we correctly move in our education about love, we will move from the love of bodies to the love of a particular body, the love of one person. Then we move from loving one body to the love of the soul. And from the love of the soul, we move to the love of knowledge and wisdom. And finally, we move to the love of perfect forms of knowledge and wisdom. We move to loving the form of beauty itself. Of the ladder of beauty, beauty leads us aloft, out of daily, mundane, prosaic things of something else, you know, something better, something higher. And it is this love of souls that drives us to perfect the soul of the beloved. Love is a longing for eternity, a longing for perfection. Remember the Platonic forms in the realm of the forms from my videos on method? Well, the Platonic forms are both perfect and eternal. This is where love finally leads to. And you know what? Socrates embodies all of the qualities of this daemon of love. You see, Platonic love is not a love merely free of sex. It is the kind of love a philosopher has, which makes philosophers the best lovers. It transcends sex because it transcends the physical. Physical beauty is merely the image, the reflection, the shadow of the form of beauty. And through the ladder of beauty, we climb up the divided line until we move from the physical realm and into the intelligible realm. We move up the divided line until we love the form of beauty itself. When we have done this, we embody the daemon of love. Aristotle, like Socrates, saw eudaimonia as the end, which is good in itself, and we need to strive for. It is the word roughly translated, well, to happiness. But now I can tell you the deeper meaning of this word. Eudaimonia literally means to have a good daemon inside of you, the daemon of love. And to possess this daemon of love is to possess happiness, as they are one and the same. And to embody the daemon of love is to possess Platonic love. As a side note, the term Platonic love came into circulation in its now accepted common interpretation from Marsilio Ficinos' work De Amor, published in 1484. Ficinos' coining of the term Platonic love comes from his interpretation of this dialogue, the Symposium. Now, what I've pretty much done here is given you a rhetorical summation of the speech that Socrates made in the Symposium. The dialogue itself, however, has a very well-developed argument for all the claims I am presenting here. The argument, well, it's quite long, probably half a dozen pages, so if you don't want to take my word for it, then please read the dialogue yourself. Lastly, what I want to do in this video is to make a connection between Platonic love and the sort of love women, well, claim to want. Now, if you look at romance novels like Twilight and all the other paranormal romance variants, what do you end up seeing? A half-man, half-supernatural being who idolizes the woman and makes her the center of his entire life with absolutely no expectation of sex or anything other than the mere pleasure of being around her. Well, we can clearly see the parallel between this female fantasy and Platonic love. The vampire, or werewolf, is the daemon of love, and she is like the form of beauty. The vampire, like the philosopher, devotes his life to the forms with no sexual component to it. The ultimate reflection of this fantasy, I believe, is very nicely summarized in the poem by Russian writer Alexander Pushkin entitled The Hapless Knight. Once there was a hapless knight, taciturn, withdrawn, pale of visage, in behavior stern, bold in spirit, generous in thought. Lo, he had a vision, fathomless and bold, branding an impression deep into his soul. From that moment on, seared to the quick, Women he abjured, not a word with any, till his grave he vowed to speak. Round his neck a stirring of beads, as a talisman he wound, and behind a steely visor's grid his face forever hid. Briming with unselfish love, faithful to a beatific vision, AMD in blood on his shield he writ. In the desert of the east, scaling rocks and dunes surmounting, every paladin into battle charged, his lady's name pronouncing. Lumen coeli sancturosa was the hapless warrior's cry, and, like a thunderbolt from high, into battle he did fly. On returning to his castle keep, he survived in strict seclusion, always silent, always stern. Thus his lonely days drew to a mad conclusion. You see, the hapless knight on his shield had transcribed AMD, Ave Mater Dei, signifying the Virgin Mary. You see, this knight idolized the Virgin Mary, and for that idol, he basically devoted his entire life to. You see, the essence of a Mangina, as I see it, seems to be exactly this hapless knight. A man who possesses the elements of platonic love for a woman, but he confuses the form of beauty with the woman herself. You know, this is every male protagonist in every romance novel ever written. The woman in these novels, however, know love in the way that Agathon knows love, the narcissistic ideation of themselves. So the hapless knight is their ideal partner then. Thanks for listening. Go team.